This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe. Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, has Greece pulled itself back from the brink of bankruptcy?
These measures are not sufficient to fix the problem, but these measures could be sufficient if the government shows enough political will to actually enact them to stave off default in the foreseeable future.
Also on Inside Europe, Spaniards fight for the roof over their heads. NATO takes stock of its Libya campaign, and Holland's coffee shops stay open to foreigners. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. The Greek government has approved austerity measures to pull the country back from bankruptcy. The measures will enable Greece to secure a 12 billion euro loan from the EU and IMF. The new austerity drive will see the implementation of 28 billion euros in spending cuts, tax hikes and privatisations. Dr. Spyros Economides specialises in European politics at the London School of Economics. I asked him if the measures were enough to quell Greece's financial woes once and for all.
No, these measures are not sufficient to fix the problem, but these measures could be sufficient if the government shows enough political will to actually enact them to stave off default in the foreseeable future and perhaps start generating the kind of revenue which will show that Greece has got the willingness and ability to move in the right direction to fix the problem. So it's only a beginning, a first step, if actually the government decides to enforce the legislation which it should pass today.
Well, this week we've seen violent protests in Greece. Are people likely to accept the package, or is more civil unrest likely?
Well, there will be more unrest. The one thing we have to keep in mind is that this unrest is not necessarily as widespread as it may seem to be. The people who are objecting and protesting outside Parliament are a snapshot of Greek society, perhaps of its extremes politically and in terms of age, lots of young people on the street. But the question is one of whether the Greek people are willing to accept these measures and willing to participate in a government plan to rescue Greece. And that is a big question. That's why there's one specific part of this legislation, of these austerity packages, which could be key, and that is the privatization of various parts of public sector corporations and industries. Because if that can be done in the short term, then perhaps we could be on the path to seeing a revenue generation which will help stabilize Greece.
Can you give me some concrete examples of how the average Greek is going to be impacted by these measures?
Well, we have to keep in mind that the average Greek has been impacted by the similar kinds of measures over the last year. In that, for example, pensioners have had their pensions cut, public sector employees have had their taxes increased and their salaries cut. And it is likely that even though it's presented as if 150,000 public sector jobs are going to go, it's more likely there won't be any recruitment over the next 5 years, which is a slightly different proposition. So the average Greek public sector worker and pensioner is suffering more than anybody else from the existing cuts and from these cuts which will be put into place as of today or tomorrow. So it is very much a group of people who are bunched in the center of the society who are being hit in their pocket directly by these austerity measures.
I mean, some analysts maintain that Greece's debt burden is so great that it's going to default anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we have to keep this in perspective. Greece's debt problem for Greece is immense. But Greece's debt problem for the Eurozone is only less than 2.5% of total Eurozone GDP. So in the grander scheme of things, one could envisage a situation in which the Eurozone partners of Greece simply do not allow it to default by pumping as much money into the economy in the short term as possible to keep it afloat. But this doesn't resolve the long-term problem. And the long-term problem can only be resolved in two ways. Realistically, by somehow making the short-term austerity measures work and reviving the Greek economy, or unrealistically, but not unlikely, a Greek default, which would lead to a disastrous situation short-term in Greece, but an uncertainty in the longer term in terms of returning to some kind of normality.
I mean, austerity measures are being pushed through throughout the eurozone. Are they all enough to save the euro in the long term?
Well, the euro will be saved in the long term one way or the other, because what you may have is a few countries dropping out if needs be. But alternatively, what you could see is the creation of a two- or three-stream Europe. It's quite likely that it won't be Greece who drops out of the eurozone, but it's Germany who drops out of the eurozone by creating its own little eurozone with a few like-minded and like-abled states going their own way. So the eurozone will maintain its role within the European Union because there are powerful enough economies and countries that want to maintain it. It's a political issue as well as an economic one, and the politics of this are paramount.
Well, staying on the political level, even if the financial problems are sorted out, has the crisis, though, irreparably damaged the idea of European unity?
Well, I think you have to answer this question from your own political perspective and ideological perspective, and where you stand depends upon where you sit. There are people who are using this crisis to say this is the end of the eurozone. It was a false optimal currency area created for political reasons without the political institutions to back it up, and we're witnessing the outcome of this now in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, perhaps Spain and Italy, and the great arguments that are taking place between Germany and other states. On the other hand, you have those very pro-European Europeans, if you like, who are saying to you, this shows exactly why we have to move towards political union. This shows exactly why a eurozone on its own cannot function without the kind of political structure around it that will give a centralized form of government, a federal state of Europe, to make it work. So this crisis is used by both sides to make their own particular point. Yes to a further integrated Europe, or no, the end to a eurozone.
And that was Dr. Spyros Economides from the London School of Economics. Well, as the Greek debt crisis threatens to plunge Europe into a new financial crisis, government officials and bankers are seeking solutions about how to share the burden of ever bigger rescue packages for Greece. Voluntary involvement of the private sector is the catchphrase in these efforts. Here in Germany, banks are still reluctant to voluntarily write off billions of euros, but there are increasing demands that taxpayers alone should not finance the bailouts, as Uwe Hessler reports.
When French President Nicolas Sarkozy announced last week that banks in his country would be willing to roll over maturing Greek government bonds into new and longer-running ones, German bankers immediately began to dig in. In principle, they said this was a possibility to relieve Greece of a huge burden of debt servicing. But it was far too early to decide and could create big risks for both banks and debt-stricken eurozone governments. Josef Ackermann, chief of Deutsche Bank, said on Monday that it would be better for banks to shoulder some of the burden rather than stand by and watch Greece go bankrupt. Michael Kemmer, head of the German Association of Private Banks, warns that the French initiative could mean entering a minefield. If financial markets get the impression that political pressure is applied to force private banks into accepting write-downs and restructuring, then I fear the worst, he says. Investors would immediately withdraw from other debt-stricken eurozone countries, thus setting off a domino effect that no one can control anymore. In the meantime, resistance is mounting in Germany to throwing ever more lifelines to Greece. A group of 100 family-owned German businesses has demanded that bailouts should be stopped immediately. Karl-Jürgen Brandt, who owns the Brandt Cookies Factory, believes enough has been done. We should no longer accept that states, which effectively means the taxpayers, continue to foot this bill, he says. Greece must leave the eurozone, and all efforts should focus on how this can be achieved in a face-saving manner for the Greek people. Such sentiments are shared by a majority of the German population, and Chancellor Merkel appears increasingly isolated and desperate in her efforts to handle the crisis. The only support she still seems to have is from big business. Some 2 weeks ago, 50 major companies, including Siemens, Daimler and Deutsche Bank, issued an appeal in favor of more money for Greece. Jürgen Thumann, the head of the European Business Leaders Association, speaks for them. There is no alternative to the eurozone, he says. We must do everything to shore up confidence in the single currency by continuing to help bail out the Greek government. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Well, in Spain, the economic crisis is also continuing to bite. There have been protests around the country against high unemployment and austerity measures. Home repossessions are on the increase as people struggle to make their mortgage payments. This is leaving many in a desperate situation. But a new civic movement is trying to stop the trend with some very direct action. Guy Hetchko reports from Madrid.
La comisión judicial encargada de efectuar el desalojo de Anwar y su familia se ha ido.
This is an increasingly common scene in Spain. Activists in Madrid celebrate having stopped officials from evicting a family that is unable to pay the mortgage on its home.
We just go there where the eviction is supposed to be. We block the building, putting as much people as we can. And what we do is we negotiate with the agent of the government that is supposed to make effective the eviction.
Eduardo Muñoz is a spokesman for one of the groups that form the May 15th movement that wants to see an overhaul of Spain's political and economic system. The movement has thrown its weight behind the campaign to stop evictions, ensuring that hundreds of people turn up at homes due to be repossessed.
The situation, rather than improving, it's getting worse. And I think people are really mad right now.
With unemployment at 21%, the highest in the European Union, more and more families are struggling to make their monthly payments. The activists have stopped about 40 evictions across Spain in recent months, but they say more than 200 are taking place every day. They accuse banks of often skirting regulations in carrying out repossessions, and they say the authorities fail to understand the desperate situation many families are left in after their property is repossessed. Aida Quinatoa is an Ecuadorian who has been campaigning for months to help immigrant families avoid eviction. Immigrants have been particularly exposed to the economic crisis as hundreds of thousands of them came to Spain to work in the construction sector. When a decade-long real estate boom collapsed in 2008, many were left jobless. Quinatoa herself says she was saddled with an exorbitant debt by a fraudulent mortgage company.
Que hay más gente que ahora ya han decidido devolver los pisos.
More and more people are having to decide to hand their properties back to the bank, so the banks have tightened things up, leaving people with more debt. The officials go to the homes, put a new lock on the door, locking the owner's belongings inside and leaving them in the street with only the clothes on their backs. There have been some very dramatic situations lately.
The bursting of the property bubble has caused property prices to drop over the last couple of years. This means that many homeowners still owe the bank money, even after they have given their property back, because it is now worth less than their original mortgage.
There was the case recently of an Ecuadorian man who took out a mortgage for 280,000 euros. He gave his apartment back to the bank, as well as all the mortgage payments he had made, and he found himself with a debt of 325,000 euros. That's more than his original mortgage.
The activists want the government to change the law related to mortgage payments, so a more sympathetic approach is taken to those who cannot pay. They would also like Spain to follow the example of some states in America, where those evicted simply hand over the keys of their property to the bank and their debt is cleared. However, the banks say that if they don't pursue these debts, then all Spaniards will end up paying the price. Ismael Sanz is an economist at Madrid's Rey Juan Carlos University.
If people do not pay back their loans, that means that banks will need to ask for more interest rates just in case some portion of these people will not be able to pay back the loans. So this is the point of view of banks.
The sound of construction work is now rarely heard in Spain. But the legacy of the real estate boom and the collapse that followed remains. Unemployment, several hundred thousand empty new homes, properties that are losing value, and families that can't keep up with their mortgage payments. Aida Quinatoa says justice needs to be done.
Hemos sido estafados, hemos sido engañados.
We've been defrauded, we've been duped. In this country, people have got rich illicitly, and those whose fault it is are not where they should be. And us, the poor, the workers, are paying the cost of this crisis.
The rise in home repossessions is just one symptom of Spain's ongoing economic struggle, and the campaign to stop evictions is just one symptom of the anger that Spaniards feel as they attempt to survive this crisis. Guy Hedgeco, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. This week marked the three-month anniversary since the start of NATO's military operations in Libya. But after more than 100 days of airstrikes, there's still no sign of a breakthrough. And recent civilian casualties have led to accusations that NATO is overstepping its United Nations mandate. Even within the alliance, some are voicing concern about where the campaign is heading. Vanessa Mock reports from Brussels.
Fury from the skies. NATO aircraft have been bombing Gaddafi regime targets for over 3 months now. But the Libyan leader still clings on to power and its stalemate on the ground. And now NATO is taking the flak for civilian deaths in two recent airstrikes.
First of all, we regret deeply any loss of life.
NATO's Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
Let me stress that it is the Gaddafi regime that is attacking systematically and in the most outrageous manner its own people. And this is a reason why the United Nations requested the international community to take action.
Reports of recent casualties in NATO airstrikes are making allies nervous, including those who first supported the mission. Italian Foreign Minister Franco Frattini told reporters last week that NATO's reputation was on the line.
La NATO è alla prova della sua credibilità.
NATO's credibility is at stake. It cannot run the risk of harming civilians. This is utterly unacceptable.
On Monday, the International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant for Gaddafi, accusing him of crimes against humanity. But for NATO, that risks prolonging war. Ian Lesser is with the German Marshall Fund in Washington.
I do think that the decision by the International Criminal Court in The Hague to call for the arrest of Gaddafi and two others obviously raises the stakes, because it would be make it much more difficult for the Gaddafi regime to accept a kind of graceful exit to a third country, simply because there would be very few places where he and his son and the head of internal security and others who've been indicted can go.
And to add to NATO's woes, key allies Britain and France are warning about the cost of the airstrikes. Others like Canada are considering pulling out in the autumn. NATO's Secretary General insists everyone is still committed.
Yes, it is a costly operation, but it would be far more costly to let a dictator like Gaddafi succeed in his crackdown on the democratic movement in Libya. This is not just about financial costs. This is also about basic democratic values, human rights, and these values are priceless.
And you're not worried about looking increasingly isolated?
On the contrary, it is a Gaddafi regime that is increasingly isolated, and that will eventually also lead to the collapse of the regime.
NATO's current mandate runs out at the end of September, and if there's no breakthrough by then, it may well be forced to reconsider its mission in Libya. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
The top court in the Netherlands has ruled that coffee shops, where you're legally allowed to smoke marijuana, can remain open to everyone, at least for now. The mayor of the border city of Maastricht used a local bylaw to close down a coffee shop for letting in foreigners, but Wednesday's ruling deemed this to be unlawful. This may sound like a victory for the coffee shop owners, but it may not last long. Catherine Bolsover reports from Maastricht.
Maastricht is a small medieval city at the southern tip of the Netherlands, nestled between its European neighbours, Belgium and Germany. Smoking cannabis in specially licensed coffee shops is legal in the Netherlands. And as a result, the freedom to smoke attracts customers from all over Europe who are hampered by tougher laws at home. The government wants to ban foreigners from coffee shops like this one in Maastricht, as they say that so-called drugs tourism, where people pop across the border for cannabis, is causing a nuisance.
In fact, the mayor of Maastricht closed down this coffee shop back in 2006 for letting in foreigners. However, the highest Dutch court, the Council of State, has ruled that closure was unlawful, in a huge victory for Maastricht coffee shop owner Mark Jossermans.
I started a court case against the government with my coffee shop because I refused to ban foreigners from my coffee shop. I do not want to discriminate. You're allowed to come to the coffee shop when you live in Holland, but you're not allowed to come to my coffee shop when you live in Belgium, only 1 kilometer over the border.
Hello, can I have your ID, please?
At Jossermans coffee shop, Easy Going, every customer has their ID scanned on the way in to check if they're over 18. The information is then kept on computers for 48 hours. If allowed through, the customers can then buy cannabis from behind two hatches in the wall. The amount is strictly regulated at 5 grams per person. There are even microscopes on hand so customers can check the quality of the product.
Thank you. Actually,
the staff at Easy Going switch between speaking Dutch, French, German and English, showing the variety of their customers' nationalities.
74% of our visitors in Maastricht are foreigners, and the other 26% are from Maastricht and other cities around Maastricht who do not have any coffee shops. Those people have to come to Maastricht also.
That is, without the foreigners, the coffee shops would go under. Jossermans says if the ruling had not gone his way, he would have had to make around 30 staff members redundant, and it would have had a knock-on effect across Maastricht. Likewise, customers in the coffee shops in Maastricht say if they were not allowed in, they'd just have to resort to illegal methods.
Yeah, I think it actually doesn't make any sense, because now the black market will be actually blooming, because everybody who cannot go to coffee shops anymore, like me for example, I would just get it on the street.
It's a shame, because it's part of the culture of Holland. Also, the black market that already exists will continue to flourish. Personally, I think more places should have a coffee shop culture like this.
If this stopped, if you were no longer allowed in, what would you do instead?
Cultivate my own, or buy in my country, in the black market.
Easy Going has been in business since 1983, and thanks to the new ruling, will continue to be open for business to foreigners for the time being. However, Jossermans says he's seen the number of coffee shops halve in the last 8 years, and fears the centre-right government may now find new obstacles to put in their way.
It seems that our new government is a bit ashamed of their own drugs policy, of their own success. I don't know why, but I think we can prove that our system works. It's much better than just saying no, but still people will continue using drugs. It always has been like that and it always will be like that.
The government wants to make the coffee shops members only, and to be a member you have to hold a Dutch passport. The proposals have already passed the lower house of parliament. Although Wednesday's ruling supported the coffee shop owners in this one case, it also suggested there would be legal leeway for the government's plans. So, while the coffee shops are open to all at the moment, this may not last for long. Catherine Bolsover, Deutsche Welle Radio, Maastricht.
Just a reminder that we like to hear your feedback on the programme. If you have any comments or queries, do get in touch with us. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. That's europe@dw-world.de. You can also write to us via snail mail. Our postal address is Inside Europe, the English Service, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. In the next half hour, are the Russian police becoming a law unto themselves? Turkey cracks down on the illegal trade in Islamic artefacts. And a new online course offers Scotch on the rocks.
Yeah, it's a home learning course, so people sign up for it online and they will be sent 3 nosing glasses and 8 miniatures, which represent whiskies, malt whiskies from the different regions in Scotland and also blended whiskies. And then they go online and it's really up to each individual student how long they wish to spend on it. But we estimate that you should be able to cover the whole course in 20 hours.
Those stories and more coming up. Ask any Russian about the police, and the likely response will be that they're corrupt, lazy, and potentially dangerous. To improve this tarnished image, Russia's police force are now undergoing a serious reform initiated by President Dmitry Medvedev. But in spite of these efforts, a majority of Russians don't feel safe at all in the presence of the police. Corruption is rampant, and the Moscow-based Public Verdict Foundation says torture is common. Gertrud Kerkamp has more.
Я Кузьмина Валентина Николаевна обращаюсь к руководителю Следственного комитета Российской Федерации Бастрыкину Александру Ивановичу.
This is Valentina Kuzmina, a Muscovite whose son, Kirill Shiborsh, was beaten to death by policemen 5 years ago. All these years, the investigation has led nowhere, and the perpetrators, whose names are known, remain unpunished. In her struggle for justice, Kirill's desperate mother even appealed to the federal authorities in a video message.
The wounds on his body indicate that they beat him while he was lying on the floor, so he was helpless. In 3.5 years, the criminal investigation was halted 10 times under the pretext that my son had died from loss of blood due to his own careless behaviour.
Kirill Shiborsh used to work as an economist and successfully published several books. However, the 38-year-old man was mentally ill and at some point needed urgent psychiatric help. But as Natalia Taubina of the Public Verdict Foundation, a Moscow-based human rights group, explains, Kirill received blows instead of aid.
Psychiatrists were called in, and the police as well, to assist. The police arrived first and didn't wait for the doctors, even though they were supposed to, according to the rules. They forced open the door. The man got scared and fled to the balcony. On the balcony, they beat him up for 2 minutes. And left him in a coma. He died 2 days later. They beat him with batons and with a table leg.
All over Russia, there are countless similar reports. People are beaten up, tortured, and raped by policemen. But only in a handful of cases does the investigation result in a trial and a conviction. And the situation is not improving, says Natalia Taubina. Only during the first 5 months of this year, more than 2,000 crimes were committed by policemen, and the real number may be significantly higher. One of the reasons is that the police have to fulfill an annual plan and produce a minimum number of arrests at the end of each year.
How else can you achieve that, except by falsifications and by using violence to force a detainee to sign a police report? We had a case where a man had to sign a simple form about an administrative arrest. He was beaten up and his arm was broken.
A recent poll shows that more than half of the population doesn't believe that the police are able to guarantee their personal safety. Instead, many perceive the force as a potential threat, and the call for another militia, as the police was known here until now, is getting louder and louder.
Нам нужна другая милиция! Нам нужна другая милиция!
From Soviet times already, police violence and rampant corruption have seriously undermined the image of the police force. Numerous attempts have been undertaken to change this, to no avail. Now President Dmitry Medvedev has initiated a police reform aimed at modernizing the force and especially combating lawlessness and corruption in the Interior Ministry, the MVD.
Ответственность сотрудников органов внутренних дел всех уровней должна быть усилена.
The responsibility of all MVD personnel must be increased. If someone committing a crime works in the MVD, this will be considered an aggravating circumstance. The same holds for not carrying out legal orders given by superiors.
Today, only one-third of Russians is satisfied with the police, and that can even be called a fairly good showing, says Taubina. Because under the police reform now underway, many people appear ready to give them the benefit of the doubt.
If society doesn't feel that when you have to appeal to the police, you will get qualified help and protection, then this trust will drop sharply.
For the police, it will be an uphill struggle. The official call for a new police anthem, which should portray policemen as honest and decent people, has provoked a wave of biting song texts on the internet, all emphasizing that it's actually the contrary which is true. Gerhard Kuhrkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
The international market in antique Islamic art is booming. For example, a single page from an historic Quran was recently sold for 200,000 euros. But an increasing number of Islamic artefacts are being sold illegally. They've been stolen from mosques or museums. Turkey, with its rich Islamic heritage, offers rich pickings to criminal gangs. And as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the authorities are struggling to curtail this growing market.
Cuma Atabay, the head of Turkey's historical foundations, listing the recent thefts of Islamic art. Among them are carpets hundreds of years old, and even a mosque door dating back to the 14th century. Atabay is speaking at an international meeting, the first of its kind in Istanbul, aimed at combating the growing problem of Islamic art theft. Listening is William Robinson, director of Islamic and carpet departments of the London-based auction house Christie's. He says with the oil-rich Gulf states entering the market, prices for Islamic art have gone through the roof.
The overall turnover within the market has risen hugely. I almost would take it back to 1997, which is basically when Qatar entered the market. And since then, the overall trend has been very, very strongly upward. And that is absolutely continuing now, particularly in the last two or three years. I'm thinking it could even be sort of 30, 40% a year increase, which is huge.
Such high prices are fueling an increasing market in stolen artefacts, many of which end up in Istanbul's famous and historical Cover Bazaar. For centuries, the bazaar, with its maze of narrow streets and thousands of shops, has been the place to buy the finest jewellery and carpets, and much, much more. But as in the past, today it still remains a centre for illegal as well as legal activity, according to Police Chief Ismail Shaheen. He heads the city's efforts against the theft and smuggling of Islamic art, much of which, he says, is destined for Europe.
You have gangs of three or four people stealing from museums or mosques. They bring them to the covered bazaar, where there are dealers who have contacts in Europe. Sometimes the middlemen will get commissions from Europe for a specific item, and they will then commission a gang to steal it. It's very difficult for us, because most mosques and even some museums don't even have inventories or protection. Once we recovered from Germany a historical piece of jewellery, a seahorse, that was stolen from a museum. Within a few months it was stolen again. Istanbul is also not only the center for Turkey for stolen artifacts, but also for wider items coming from the turmoil in the Middle East.
Stemming this growing trade in illegal artifacts is information. According to Dr. Jürgen Gilix, who spent the last 3 years working for a Gulf State Islamic art museum.
I believe one can only win the fight if when using modern technology, is having a very good, complete documentation to know actually what is in the museums, what belongs to the foundation, and so on and so forth, and make this kind of accessible. There is a extensive use, for example, of databases, online accessible databases, or even if you would put, to bring it to the extreme, on, let's say, on Facebook, for collectors and also for the people on the street, but also, of course, in the institution, it has to be increased.
Already, the appearance of catalogues by auctions on the internet is proving a powerful tool in curtailing the sale of stolen artefacts. That publicity is the greatest defence in the battle against the criminal world, says Robinson of Christie's. But he says this important fight is sometimes hindered by the people they're trying to help, which could have far-reaching consequences for the market.
Oh, it's a very serious issue because it is completely against our interests for illegal things to appear on the market, let alone with us, because it actually knocks the whole market. But if we're not aware of the theft, we're in a much more difficult situation. And there's one instance of a country where I'm aware of a major theft that took place, and I asked the ambassador, I asked two different successive ambassadors in London, please can I have details? And for reasons of national pride, he didn't give me any details. Now, that attitude is never going to be helpful long term. We want owners to have confidence that something they buy from us in 30 years' time is not going to be claimed.
Robinson draws a parallel with the 1990s, when the growing awareness of the sale of art taken by the Nazis during World War II finally brought that trade to an end. The battle against this latest illegal trade is expected to be no less intense, especially as the market continues to head north. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
If you have access to the internet, 20 hours to spare, and like a tipple or two of whiskey, then you might want to check out a new educational opportunity. Scotland's Moray College has just launched a unique online course to explain the complexities of Scotch whisky, and it's already attracting interest from around the world. To find out more, I spoke to the course's tutor, Jim Cryle, an authority on whisky.
Well, it's a continuation from a course that was actually created about 10 or 12 years ago. Originally it was in a little booklet form. It was developed jointly by Moray College and Gordon MacPhail, and it was in booklet form, and then about 5 or 6 years ago it was changed to a DVD format. But there have been quite significant changes to the law in relation to Scotch whisky. New regulations were introduced in 2009, or at the end of 2009, and so the course really needed to be updated, and it needed to concentrate more on whisky and not so much concentration on other spirits. So I have rewritten the whole course, and it is about whisky, both Scotch whisky and from countries other than Scotland.
So what exactly are students going to be learning about? I believe it's a 20-hour course.
Yeah, it's a home learning course, so people sign up for it online, and they will be sent three nosing glasses and eight miniatures, which represent whiskies, malt whiskies from the different regions in Scotland, and also blended whiskies. And then they go online, and it's really up to each individual student how long they wish to spend on it. But we estimate that you should be able to cover the whole course in 20 hours. And so it's broken down into about eight different sections. There is a section on the history of Scotch whisky, then into how Scotch whisky is made, particularly malt whisky. And then there's a section on grain whisky and blending. There are sections on whiskies from America, Canada, Japan, and so on, other major producers around the world. There's a little bit about the legal requirements for different whiskies, and Scotch whisky in particular. And then you finish off by doing a tasting and recording your results. And at the end of all that, there are two assessment papers. It's about 15 questions on each paper. People complete that, send it back online along with their tasting notes to myself, who will mark it up, and if they're successful, then they're awarded a certificate by the college.
And how much interest has there been so far from students, and from which countries?
There's been an amazing response very early on the basis it was only launched a couple of weeks ago. But we have people from the USA, from Canada, from the UK, of course, and there's been one from Venezuela, and also Scandinavia. So lots of interest, and about six of those people have signed up for the course so far.
Now, you mentioned the section on whiskies from other countries like Canada and Japan. In your personal opinion, how do these foreign whiskies measure up to the Scotch variety?
Well, they're different in as much as they are made in a different way, or they are made using different types of cereal and different strains of yeast and so on. So they are all different. The Canadian whiskies are really very not like Scotch whiskey. They tend to be sweeter. They tend to have wine flavorings and so on in them, which you don't get to such a big extent in Scotch whiskey. The Japanese, they have copied everything Scottish, and to be fair, they are making very good quality whiskey. But of course, it'll never be Scotch whiskey, because you can only have Scotch whiskey from Scotland.
Although I believe that Japanese companies now own various distilleries in Scotland, has that had an impact on the industry?
It's had no impact on the industry, no, because the sad thing is that most of Scotch whisky distilleries are owned by companies from out with Scotland. So the company I previously worked for when I was at the Glenlivet Distillery is owned by Pernod Ricard of France, which is now a big company. And you have the other very large company is Diageo, which is partly Irish-owned by Guinness. So, and there are several distilleries which are owned by Japanese companies. So not many family-owned distilleries left, sadly.
How important, then, is whisky to the Scottish economy?
Oh, it's hugely important, not only to the Scottish economy, but to the whole of the UK economy. It's about number four in terms of export earnings. In 2010, the sales of Scotch whisky abroad in overseas markets raised, I think it was something like £3.4 billion in revenue earnings. So, I mean, that's a massive income to the company.
Jim, you're an authority on whisky. You've obviously been sampling it for some time. What's your favourite tipple?
Oh, gosh. There are so many different ones to choose from. But, I mean, for the last 10 years of my full-time working life, I was up at the Glenlivet Distillery. And my favourite out of that is the 18-year-old Glenlivet.
And has your taste changed over the years?
Oh, I think it does. I think people mature into drinking Scotch whisky. It's not something that young people drink, or certainly not here anyway. And I think as your palate changes, as your taste changes, then you graduate into more flavoursome things and you graduate into Scotch whisky.
And that was Jim Cryle, the tutor of a new online course on Scotch whisky. And if you'd like to learn more about the course, then check out the website of Moray College in Scotland. I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Florence, the final whistle has been blown in a rather unusual football tournament. The game, called Calcio Storico, or Historic Football, is like no other. It's more of a street brawl than a match. There are just four teams, the games take place in June, and the players wear medieval costume. The tournament's been played for centuries, but this spectacle is now under threat. Episodes of violence have seen tournaments cancelled, players indicted, and avid fans alienated from the game. Jean Di Marino has more from Florence.
With a war cry from the Middle Ages, the final of Calcio Storico Fiorentino, or Florence's historic football kicks off. But more than the usual tension grips the crowd. After hundreds of years, the future of the game hangs in the balance. Calcio Storico takes place each year, reenacting an event in 1530. The Florentines staged a game of football to thumb their noses at the troops of Emperor Charles V, who'd besieged the city for months. Calcio Storico's president, Michele Pierguidi, says its calcianti, or players, have since included some famous names.
L'ha giocato anche tre papi, l'hanno giocato I Medici.
Three popes played it, so did the Medici family. All the Florentine nobles played it. It's something very close to our heart. It's typically ours. You won't see it anywhere else.
It's more a street brawl than a football match. The calcianti don medieval costume and spend 50 minutes boxing, wrestling, performing martial arts and occasionally passing the ball, all in pursuit of a catcher or goal. It's the ferocity of play that has threatened the survival of the game.
Calcio Storico was at risk of dying. A lot of people distanced themselves, and it's very difficult to make them love the sport again when they've distanced themselves.
Journalist and author Mauro Bonciani says there hasn't been a regular tournament for years due to the violence. The two teams playing in the final this year, the Bianchi or Whites and the Azzurri or Blues, have been in the thick of it. When they last met, in the semi-final of 2006, the calcianti set upon each other. The tournament was cancelled, play was suspended the next year as well. Many of the kickers were indicted. Yet when the rules were changed to tone it all down, some of the teams withdrew. President Michele Pierguidi says matters have been rectified. Sucker punches and head kicks are out. Pretty much everything else goes.
Calciante deve essere una persona con onore, con lealtà.
A calciante must be a person of honour and fairness, so he can throw a punch at someone who is ready. He can't attack an adversary who's not looking. That's foul play.
The rules may have been changed, but the controversy continues. The interruptions to the game over the past few years have alienated locals. According to one resident, a bar proprietor, it's a spectacle for tourists only now.
It's not very popular among Florentines anymore. There are only a few local supporters, limited to the friends of the players, and that's all.
For centuries, the four teams competing in the league have been drawn from the suburbs of the historical centre. The Bianchi are from Santo Spirito, the Azzurri, Santa Croce, the Rossi or Reds, Santa Maria Novella, and the Verdi or Greens, San Giovanni. But in recent years, they've moved out to the periphery. Few players live in the centre. Some are not even Florentine. Critics complain the game is losing its origins. The president says it's the only way to survive.
We've decided that it's the strongest players who must play. It's not obligatory to be born in Florence or be from Florence. Whoever is a calciante is a calciante.
The Bianchi's captain, Marino Vieri, says other characteristics are more important.
Calciante si diventa, non si nasce, perché ci vuole coraggio.
You become a kicker, you're not born one. You need courage, dedication, passion, and the will to win.
At the final cannon shot, the Azzurri win 2.5 to 1.5. Only 6 players were stretchered off to hospital for treatment this year. It's a game the president praises for its sportsmanship. It seems that violence, like many other things, is relative. Gene De Marino, Deutsche Welle Radio.
It's Germany's most beloved old-timer, the Volkswagen Beetle. Around 21 million of them were sold worldwide. In fact, for decades, the Beetle held the record for the highest sales of any car model, until it was overtaken by the somewhat less cool VW Golf in 2002. Well, 40,000 Beetles still populate German roads, kept running by meticulous car lovers and tinkerers. One of them took our reporter, Jan Bruck, for a ride.
Hello.
Does this sound ring a bell? It's a German national treasure on four wheels, the VW Beetle. This one belongs to amateur restorer Willy Hahn from Cologne. He's 43 years old and has been restoring the iconic cars for 25 years now. On weekends, when the weather is nice, he takes his 1972 Beetle with 50 HP out for a ride.
To drive a Beetle in a weather like that, with the roof open, that is something which you do not have in a usual car. I mean, driving a Beetle is hard work, let's say. And even when you drive into a curve, there's nothing which would help you if you are too fast.
The concept of the Beetle goes back to famous car engineer Ferdinand Porsche. During the Nazi era, he worked on developing a car that the majority of the German population would be able to afford. In the 1950s, the Beetle became a symbol of the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the miraculous recovery of the German economy.
My parents had a Beetle, my grandparents, they drove Beetle, so maybe every German drove a Beetle, yeah, but it was nothing really particular for me. But when I bought my first one, then really quick I realized, okay, that's an easy car. It's making a lot of fun to drive it because it's special.
Restoring Beetles has been a lifelong passion for Willy. An old lady gave him the Beetle he's working on right now. She didn't want to see her Hugo, that's the name she gave the car, end up in a junkyard. Now it's jacked up in the small garage at Willy's in-laws. But there's still a long way to go.
I mean, restoring means really getting everything refreshed like this year. Yeah, getting rid of the under chassis and just put everything out. This is something you do two or three times in your life, maybe most of the people one time in their life.
In his daytime job, Willy works as an engineer for car transmissions at Ford.
Currently, it's really hard because I'm working 10 hours per day, so it's hard for me to find the time where I can work on the Beetle. But the Saturday, that is, let's say, my day, where my wife said, okay, Saturday, that is something where you can work on the car.
Willy is a member of the Käferfreunde Köln, one of the many VW Beetle clubs all over Germany. 40 members go on Beetle outings together or discuss the joys and pitfalls of restoring. Sometimes Willy's wife Christiane joins him for the club events.
What I like most about the car are the reactions of the people when we go for a ride. Almost everyone over 50 had a Beetle, and there are so many personal memories and stories connected to it.
In the basement of his house, Willy works on restoring the original Beetle four-cylinder boxer engine. The room is packed with shiny tools and antique spare parts. Here, Willy feels at home.
That's really fun for me, working with the car, because in the usual job, yeah, in my day job, I often had the problem I kicked off things, but then the development time of a transmission is 2 years. Yeah, here, it's my own. Cutting it, yeah, get rid of the old stuff. I can see it. It's something which you can do within a couple of hours. It's really relaxing me at the end. Yeah, you can see I'm dirty, but I don't care.
If everything goes according to plan and Willy has fully restored Hugo by 2012, he wants to take part in a winter old-timer rally. However, the Beetle has to be exactly like it was when it left the Volkswagen factory in 1972. Quite a challenge, but for Willy, that's exactly what he wants his Beetles to be. Jan Bruck, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And that's all we've time for on this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. And do join us at the same time next week. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Helen Sini, my colleague Neil King, and sound engineer Michael Springer. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.